A Double-Barreled Detective Story, Mark Twain. Part 1. We ought never to do wrong when people are looking. Section 1. The first scene's in the country, in Virginia. The time, 1880. There's been a wedding between a handsome young man of slender means and a rich young girl. A case of love at first sight and a precipitate marriage, a marriage bitterly opposed by the girl's widowed father. Jacob Fuller, the bridegroom, is 26 years old, is of an old but unconsidered family, which had by compulsion emigrated from Sedgemoor, and for King James's purse's profit, so everybody said, some maliciously, the rest merely because they believed it. The bride is 19 and beautiful. She's intense, high-strung, romantic, immeasurably proud of her cavalier blood, and passionate in her love for her young husband. For its sake, she braved her father's displeasure, endured his reproaches, listened with loyalty unshaken to his warning predictions, and went from his house without his blessing, proud and happy in the proofs she was thus giving of the quality of the affection which had made its home in her heart. The morning after the marriage, there was a sad surprise for her. Her husband put aside her proffered caresses and said, "Sit down. I have something to say to you. I loved you. That was before I asked your father to give you to me. His refusal is not my grievance. I could have endured that. But the things he said of me to you, that's a different matter. There, you needn't speak. I know quite well what they were. I got them from authentic sources. Among other things, he said that my character was written in my face, that I was treacherous, a dissembler, a coward, and a brute without sense of pity or compassion. The Sedgemoor trademark, he called it, and white sleeve badge. Any other man in my place would have gone to his house and shot him down like a dog. I wanted to do it, and was minded to do it, but a better thought came to me, to put him to shame, to break his heart, to kill him by inches. How to do it? Through my treatment of you, his idol. I would marry you, and then have patience, you will see." From that moment onward, for 3 months, the young wife suffered all the humiliations, all the insults, all the miseries that the diligent and inventive mind of the husband could contrive, save physical injuries only. Her strong pride stood by her, and she kept the secret of her troubles. Now and then the husband said, "Why don't you go to your father and tell him?" Then he invented new tortures, applied them, and asked again. She always answered, "He shall never know by my mouth," and taunted him with his origin. Said she was the lawful slave of a scion of slaves, and must obey, and would. Up to that point, but no further. He could kill her if he liked, but he could not break her. It was not in the Sedgemoor breed to do it. At the end of the 3 months, he said, with a dark significance in his manner, "I have tried all things but one," and waited for her reply. "Try that," she said, and curled her lip in mockery. That night, he rose at midnight and put on his clothes, then said to her, "Get up and dress." She obeyed, as always, without a word. He led her half a mile from the house, and proceeded to lash her to a tree by the side of the public road, and succeeded, she screaming and struggling. He gagged her then, struck her across the face with his cowhide, and set his bloodhounds on her. They tore the clothes off her, and she was naked. He called the dogs off and said, "You will be found by the passing public. They will be dropping along about 3 hours from now, and we'll spread the news, do you hear? Goodbye. You've seen the last of me." He went away then. She moaned to herself, "I shall bear a child to him. God grant it may be a boy." The farmers released her by and by and spread the news, which was natural. They raised the country with lynching intentions, but the bird had flown. The young wife shut herself up in her father's house. He shut himself up with her, and thenceforth would see no one. His pride was broken, and his heart. So he wasted away day by day, and even his daughter rejoiced when death relieved him. Then she sold the estate and disappeared. Section 2. In 1886, a young woman was living in a modest house near a secluded New England village, with no company but a little boy about 5 years old. She did her own work. She discouraged acquaintanceships and had none. The butcher, the baker, and the others that served her could tell the villagers nothing about her further than that her name was Stillman and that she called the child Archie. Whence she came, they had not been able to find out, but they said she talked like a southerner. The child had no playmates and no comrade and no teacher but the mother. She taught him diligently and intelligently and was satisfied with the results, even a little proud of them. One day, Archie said, "Mama, am I different from other children?" "Well, I suppose not. Why?" "There was a child going along out there and asked me if the postman had been by, and I said yes. And she said, 'How long since I saw him?' And I said, 'I hadn't seen him at all.' And she said, 'How did I know he'd been by then?' And I said, 'Because I smelt his track on the sidewalk.' And she said I was a dumb fool and made a mouth at me." "What did she do that for?" The young woman turned white and said to herself, "It's a birthmark. The gift of the bloodhound is in him." She snatched the boy to her breast and hugged him passionately, saying, "God has appointed the way." Her eyes were burning with a fierce light, and her breath came short and quick with excitement. She said to herself, "The puzzle is solved now. Many a time it's been a mystery to me, the impossible things the child has done in the dark, but it's all clear to me now." She set him in his small chair and said, "Wait a little till I come, dear, then we'll talk about the matter." She went up to her room and took from her dressing table several small articles and put them out of sight: a nail file on the floor under the bed, a pair of nail scissors under the bureau, a small ivory paper knife under the wardrobe. Then she returned and said, "There, I've left some things which I ought to have brought down." She named them and said, "Run up and bring them, dear." The child hurried away on his errand and was soon back again with the things. "Did you have any difficulty, dear?" "No, Mama. I only went where you went." During his absence, she had stepped into the bookcase, taken several books from the bottom shelf, opened each, passed her hand over a page, noting its number in her memory, then restored them to their places. "Now," she said, "I've been doing something while you've been gone, Archie. Do you think you can find out what it was?" The boy went to the bookcase and got out the books that had been touched and opened them at the pages which had been stroked. The mother took him in her lap and said, "I will answer your question now, dear. I have found out that in one way you are quite different from other people. You can see in the dark. You can smell what other people cannot. You have the talents of a bloodhound. They're good and valuable things to have, but you must keep the matter a secret. If people found it out, they would speak of you as an odd child, a strange child, and children would be disagreeable to you and give you nicknames. In this world, one must be like everybody else if he doesn't want to provoke scorn or envy or jealousy. It's a great and fine distinction which has been born to you, and I'm glad. But you'll keep it a secret, for Mama's sake, won't you?" The child promised, without understanding. All the rest of the day, the mother's brain was busy with excited thinkings, with plans, projects, schemes, each and all of them uncanny, grim, and dark. Yet they lit up her face, lit it with the fell light of their own, lit it with vague fires of hell. She was in a fever of unrest. She couldn't sit, stand, read, sew. There was no relief for her but in movement. She tested her boy's gift in 20 ways and kept saying to herself all the time, with her mind in the past, "He broke my father's heart, and night and day all these years I've tried, and all in vain, to think out a way to break his. I've found it now. I have found it now." When night fell, the demon of unrest still possessed her. She went on with her tests. With a candle, she traversed the house from garret to cellar, hiding pins, needles, thimbles, spools, under pillows, under carpets, in cracks in the walls, under the coal in the bin. Then sent the little fellow in the dark to find them, which he did, and was happy and proud when she praised him and smothered him with caresses. From this time forward, life took on a new complexion for her. She said, "The future is secure. I can wait and enjoy the waiting." The most of her lost interests revived. She took up music again, and languages, drawing, painting, and the other long-discarded delights of her maidenhood. She was happy once more, and felt again the zest of life. As the years drifted by, she watched the development of her boy, and was contented with it. Not altogether, but nearly that. The soft side of his heart was larger than the other side of it. It was his only defect in her eyes. But she considered that his love for her and worship of her made up for it. He was a good hater, that was well, but it was a question if the materials of his hatreds were of as tough and enduring a quality as those of his friendships. And that was not so well. The years drifted on. Archie was become a handsome, shapely, athletic youth, courteous, dignified, companionable, pleasant in his ways, and looking perhaps a trifle older than he was, which was 16. One evening, his mother said she had something of grave importance to say to him, adding that he was old enough to hear it now, and old enough and possessed of character enough and stability enough to carry out a stern plan which she had been for years contriving and maturing. Then she told him her bitter story, in all its naked atrociousness. For a while the boy was paralyzed. Then he said, "I understand. We are Southerners, and by our custom and nature there is but one atonement. I will search him out and kill him." "Kill him? No. Death is release, emancipation. Death is a favor. Do I owe him favors? You must not hurt a hair of his head." The boy was lost in thought a while. Then he said, "You are all the world to me, and your desire is my law and my pleasure. Tell me what to do, and I will do it." The mother's eyes beamed with satisfaction, and she said, "You will go and find him. I have known his hiding place for 11 years. It cost me 5 years and more of inquiry and much money to locate it. He's a quartz miner in Colorado and well-to-do. He lives in Denver. His name is Jacob Fuller. There, it's the first time I've spoken it since that unforgettable night. Think, that name could have been yours if I had not saved you that shame and furnished you a cleaner one. You will drive him from that place. You will hunt him down and drive him again, and yet again, and again, and again, persistently, relentlessly, poisoning his life, filling it with mysterious terrors, loading it with weariness and misery, making him wish for death, and that he had a suicide's courage. You'll make of him another wandering Jew. He shall know no rest anymore, no peace of mind, no placid sleep. You shall shadow him, cling to him, persecute him, till you break his heart, as he broke my father's and mine. I will obey, mother. I believe it, my child. The preparations are all made. Everything is ready. Here's a letter of credit. Spend freely. There is no lack of money. At times you may need disguises. I have provided them. Also, some other conveniences. She took from the drawer of the typewriter table several squares of paper. They all bore these typewritten words. $10,000 reward. It is believed that a certain man who is wanted in an eastern state is sojourning here. In 1880, in the night, he tied his young wife to a tree by the public road, cut her across the face with a cowhide, and made his dogs tear her clothes from her, leaving her naked. He left her there and fled the country. A blood relative of hers has searched for him for 17 years. Address, post office. The above reward will be paid in cash to the person who will furnish the seeker, in a personal interview, the criminal's address. When you have found him and acquainted yourself with his scent, you will go in the night and placard one of these upon the building he occupies, and another one upon the post office or in some other prominent place. It will be the talk of the region. At first, you must give him several days in which to force a sale of his belongings at something approaching their value. We will ruin him by and by, but gradually. We must not impoverish him at once, for that would bring him to despair and injure his health, possibly kill him. She took three or four more typewritten forms from the drawer, duplicates, and read one. Date, 18, blah, blah. To Jacob Fuller. You have X amount of days in which to settle your affairs. You will not be disturbed during that limit, which will expire at such and such a date and such a month of such and such a year. You must then move on. If you are still in the place after the named hour, I will placard you on all the dead walls, detailing your crime once more, and adding the date, also the scene of it, with all names concerned, including your own. Have no fear of bodily injury. It will in no circumstances ever be inflicted upon you. You brought misery upon an old man, and ruined his life and broke his heart. What he suffered, you are to suffer. You will add no signature. He must receive this before he learns of the reward placard, before he rises in the morning, lest he lose his head and fly the place penniless. I shall not forget, Mama. You will need to use these forms only in the beginning. Once may be enough. Afterward, when you're ready for him to vanish out of a place, see that he gets a copy of this form, which merely says, "Move on. You have X amount of days." He will obey. That is sure. Section 3. Extracts from Letters to the Mother. Denver, April 3rd, 1897. I have now been living several days in the same hotel with Jacob Fuller. I have his scent. I could track him through 10 divisions of infantry and find him. I have often been near him and heard him talk. He owns a good mine and has a fair income from it, but he's not rich. He learned mining in a good way, by working at it for wages. He is a cheerful creature, and his 43 years sit lightly upon him. He could pass for a younger man, say 36 or 37. He has never married again, passes himself off for a widower. He stands well, is liked, is popular, and has many friends. Even I feel a drawing toward him, the paternal blood in me making its claim. How blind and unreasoning and arbitrary are some of the laws of nature, the most of them, in fact. My task has become hard now. You realize it? You comprehend and make allowances? and the fire of it has cooled more than I like to confess to myself. But I'll carry it out. Even with the pleasure paled, the duty remains, and I will not spare him. And for my help, a sharp resentment rises in me when I reflect that he who committed that odious crime is the only one who has not suffered by it. The lesson of it has manifestly reformed his character, and in the change, he is happy. He, the guilty party, is absolved from all suffering. You, the innocent, are borne down with it. But be comforted, he shall harvest his share. Silver Gulch, May 19. I placarded form number 1 at midnight of April the 3rd. An hour later, I slipped form number 2 under his chamber door, notifying him to leave Denver at or before 11:50 the night of the 14th. Some late bird of a reporter stole one of my placards, then hunted the town over and found the other one and stole that. In this manner, he accomplished what the profession call a scoop. That is, he got a valuable item and saw to it that no other paper got it. And so his paper, the principal one in the town, had it in glaring type on the editorial page in the morning, followed by a Vesuvian opinion of our wretch a column long, which wound up by adding $1,000 to our reward on the paper's account. The journals out here know how to do the noble thing when there's business in it. At breakfast, I occupied my usual seat, selected because it afforded a view of Papa Fuller's face, and was near enough for me to hear the talk that went on at his table. 75 or 100 people were in the room, and all discussing that item, and saying they hoped the seeker would find that rascal and remove the pollution of his presence from the town, with a rail, or a bullet, or something. When Fuller came in, he had the notice to leave, folded up, in one hand, and the newspaper in the other, and it gave me more than half a pang to see him. His cheerfulness was all gone, and he looked old and pinched and ashy. And then, only think of the things he had to listen to, Mama. He heard his own unsuspecting friends describe him with epithets and characterizations drawn from the very dictionaries and phrase books of Satan's own authorized editions down below. And more than that, he had to agree with the verdicts and applaud them. His applause tasted bitter in his mouth. He could not disguise that from me. And it was observable that his appetite was gone. He only nibbled. He couldn't eat. Finally, a man said, "It is quite likely that that relative is in the room and hearing what this town thinks of that unspeakable scoundrel. I hope so." Ah, dear, it was pitiful the way Fuller winced and glanced around scared. He couldn't endure any more and got up and left. During several days, he gave out that he had bought a mine in Mexico and wanted to sell out and go down there as soon as he could and give the property his personal attention. He played his cards well, said he would take $40,000, a quarter in cash, the rest in safe notes. But that, as he greatly needed money on account of his new purchase, he would diminish his terms for cash in full. He sold out for $30,000. And then, what do you think he did? He asked for greenbacks, and took them, saying the man in Mexico was a New Englander with a head full of crotchets and preferred greenbacks to gold or drafts. People thought it queer, since a draft on New York would produce greenbacks quite conveniently. There was talk of this odd thing, but only for a day. That is as long as any topic lasts in Denver. I was watching all the time. As soon as the sale was completed and the money paid, which was on the 11th, I began to stick to Fuller's track without dropping it for a moment. That night, no, 12th, for it was a little past midnight, I tracked him to his room, which was 4 doors from mine in the same hall. Then I went back and put on my muddy day laborer's disguise, darkened my complexion, and sat down in my room in the gloom, with a gripsack handy, with a change in it, and my door ajar, for I suspected that the bird would take wing now. In half an hour an old woman passed by, carrying a grip. I caught the familiar whiff, and followed with my grip, for it was fuller. He left the hotel by a side entrance, and at the corner he turned up an unfrequented street and walked 3 blocks in a light rain and a heavy darkness, and got into a 2-horse hack, which of course was waiting for him by appointment. I took a seat, uninvited, on the trunk platform behind, and we drove off briskly. We drove 10 miles, and the hack stopped at a way station and was discharged. Fuller got out and took a seat on a barrow under the awning, as far as he could get from the light. I went inside and watched the ticket office. Fuller bought no ticket. I bought none. Presently the train came along, and he boarded a car. I entered the same car at the other end and came down the aisle and took the seat behind him. When he paid the conductor and named his objective point, I dropped back several seats while the conductor was changing a bill, and when he came to me, I paid to the same place, about 100 miles westward. From that time, for a week on end, he led me a dance. He traveled here and there and yonder, always on a general westward trend. But he was not a woman after the first day. He was a laborer, like myself, and wore bushy, false whiskers. His outfit was perfect, and he could do the character without thinking about it, for he had served the trade for wages. His nearest friend could not have recognized him. At last, he located himself here, the obscurest little mountain camp in Montana. He was a shanty, and goes out prospecting daily, is gone all day, and avoids society. I am living at a miner's boarding house, and it's an awful place. The bunks, the food, the dirt, everything. We've been here 4 weeks, and in that time I've seen him but once. But every night I go over his track and post myself. As soon as he engaged a shanty here, I went to a town 50 miles away and telegraphed that Denver hotel to keep my baggage till I should send for it. I need nothing here but a change of army shirts, and I brought that with me. Silver Gulch, June 12th. The Denver episode has never found its way here, I think. I know the most of the men in camp, and they have never referred to it, at least in my hearing. Fuller doubtless feels quite safe in these conditions. He's located a claim 2 miles away in an out-of-the-way place in the mountains. It promises very well, and he's working it diligently. Ah, but the change in him. He never smiles, and he keeps quite to himself, consorting with no one. He who was so fond of company and so cheery only 2 months ago. I've seen him passing along several times recently, drooping, forlorn, the spring gone from his step, a pathetic figure. He calls himself David Wilson. I can trust him to remain here until we disturb him. Since you insist, I will banish him again. But I do not see how he can be unhappier than he already is. I will go back to Denver and treat myself to a little season of comfort, and edible food, and endurable beds, and bodily decency. Then I will fetch my things and notify poor Papa Wilson to move on. Denver, June 19th. They miss him here. They all hope he is prospering in Mexico, and they do not say it just with their mouths, but out of their hearts. You know, one can always tell. I'm loitering here over long, I confess it, but if you were in my place, you would have charity for me. Yes, I know what you'll say, and you're right. If I were in your place, and carried your scalding memories in my heart, I will take the train back tomorrow. Denver, June 20th. God forgive us, Mother. We are hunting the wrong man. I have not slept any all night. I am now waiting at dawn for the morning train, and how the minutes drag, how they drag. This Jacob Fuller is a cousin of the guilty one. How stupid we have been not to reflect that the guilty one would never again wear his own name after that fiendish deed. The Denver Fuller is 4 years younger than the other one. He came here a young widower in 79, age 21, a year before you were married, and the documents to prove it are innumerable. Last night I talked with familiar friends of his who've known him from the day of his arrival. I said nothing, but a few days from now I will land him in this town again with the loss upon his mind made good. And there will be a banquet and a torchlight procession, and there will not be any expense on anybody but me. Do you call this gush? I'm only a boy, as you well know. It's my privilege. By and by I shall not be a boy any more. Silver Gulch, July 3rd. Mother, he's gone. Gone and left no trace. The scent was cold when I came. Today I'm out of bed for the first time since. I wish I were not a boy. Then I could stand shocks better. They all think he went west. I start tonight in a wagon. 2 or 3 hours of that, then I get a train. I don't know where I'm going, but I must go. To try to keep still would be torture. Of course he has effaced himself with a new name and a disguise. This means that I may have to search the whole globe to find him. Indeed, it's what I expect. Do you see, Mother? It is I that am the wandering Jew, the irony of it. We arrange that for another. Think of the difficulties, and there would be none if I only could advertise for him. But if there is any way to do it that would not frighten him, I have not been able to think it out, and I have tried till all my brains are addled. If the gentleman who lately bought a mine in Mexico and sold one in Denver will send his address to... To whom, Mother? It will be explained to him that it was all a mistake. His forgiveness will be asked, and full reparation made for a loss which he sustained in a certain matter. Do you see? He would think it a trap. Well, anyone would. If I should say, it is now known that he was not the man wanted, but another man, a man who once bore the same name, but discarded it for good reasons, would that answer? But the Denver people would wake up then and say, "Aho!" And they would remember about the suspicious greenbacks and say, "Why did he run away if he wasn't the right man?" It's too thin. If I failed to find him, he would be ruined there. There, where there's no taint upon him now. You have a better head than mine. Help me. I have one clue and only one. I know his handwriting. If he puts his new false name upon a hotel register and does not disguise it too much, it'll be valuable to me if I ever run across it. San Francisco, June 28th, 1898. You already know how well I have searched the states from Colorado to the Pacific and how nearly I came to getting him once. Well, I've had another close miss. It was here, yesterday. I struck his trail, hot, on the street, and followed it on a run to a cheap hotel. That was a costly mistake. A dog would have gone the other way. But I'm only part dog, and can get very humanly stupid when excited. He'd been stopping in that house 10 days. I almost know, now, that he stops long nowhere, the past 6 or 8 months, but is restless and has to keep moving. I understand that feeling, and I know what it is to feel it. He still uses the name he had registered when I came so near catching him 9 months ago. James Walker. Doubtless the same he adopted when he fled from Silver Gulch. An unpretending man, and has small taste for fancy names. I recognize the hand easily, through its slight disguise. A square man, and not good at shams and pretenses. They said he was just gone, on a journey, left no address, didn't say where he was going, looked frightened when asked to leave his address, had no baggage but a cheap valise, carried it off on foot, a stingy old person, and not much loss to the house. Old? I suppose he is now. I hardly heard. I was there but a moment. I rushed along his trail, and it led me to a wharf. Mother, the smoke of the steamer he had taken was just fading out on the horizon. I should have saved half an hour if I had gone in the right direction at first. I could have taken a fast tug and should have stood a chance of catching that vessel. She's bound for Melbourne. Hope Canyon, California, October 3rd, 1900. You have a right to complain. A letter a year is a paucity. I freely acknowledge it. But how can one write when there's nothing to write about but failures? No one can keep it up. It breaks the heart. I told you, it seems ages ago now, how I missed him at Melbourne, and then chased him all over Australasia for months on end. Well, then, after that, I followed him to India, almost saw him in Bombay, traced him all around, to Baroda, Rawalpindi, Lucknow, Lahore, Cawnpore, Allahabad, Calcutta, Madras, oh, everywhere, week after week, month after month, through the dust and swelter, always approximately on his track, sometimes close upon him, yet never catching him, and down to Ceylon, and then to, never mind, by and by I will write it all out. I chased him home to California, and down to Mexico, and back again to California. Since then, I've been hunting him about the state from the 1st of last January down to a month ago. I feel almost sure he's not far from Hope Canyon. I traced him to a point 30 miles from here, but there I lost the trail. Someone gave him a lift in a wagon, I suppose. I'm taking a rest now, modified by searchings for the lost trail. I was tired to death, Mother, and low-spirited, and sometimes coming uncomfortably near to losing hope. But the miners in this little camp are good fellows, and I'm used to their sort this long time back, and their breezy ways freshen a person up and make him forget his troubles. I've been here a month. I'm cabining with a young fellow named Sammy Hillier, about 25, the only son of his mother, like me, and loves her dearly and writes to her every week, part of which is like me. He's a timid body, and in the matter of intellect, well, he cannot be depended upon to set a river on fire. But no matter, he's well-liked. He's good and fine, and it's meat and bread and rest and luxury to sit and talk with him and have a comradeship again. I wish James Walker could have it. He had friends. He liked company. That brings up that picture of him, the time that I saw him last. The pathos of it. It comes before me often and often. At that very time, poor thing, I was girding up my conscience to make him move again. Hillier's heart's better than mine, better than anybody's in the community, I suppose, for he's the one friend of the black sheep of the camp, Flint Buckner, and the only man Flint ever talks with or allows to talk with him. He says he knows Flint's history, and that it's trouble that has made him what he is, and so one ought to be as charitable toward him as one can. Now, none but a pretty large heart could find space to accommodate a lodger like Flint Buckner, from all I hear about him outside. I think that this one detail will give you a better idea of Sammy's character than any labored-out description I could furnish you of him. In one of our talks, he said something about like this. Flint is a kinsman of mine, and he pours out all his troubles to me, empties his breast from time to time, or I reckon it would burst. There couldn't be any unhappier man, Archie Stillman. His life had been made up of misery of mind. He isn't near as old as he looks. He has lost the feel of reposefulness and peace, oh, years and years ago. He doesn't know what good luck is, never has had any. Often says he wishes he was in the other hell, he's so tired of this one.